But we thank you very much for listening at this moment in time to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. And certainly, he shaped it for tomorrow. And thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all.
Thailand, three sniffer dogs have joined the fight against the third wave of the pandemic in the country. The canines sniff hundreds of sweat samples per day to detect COVID patients who display no symptoms. The samples are from local medical volunteers as well as bedridden patients who are not able to show up at testing centers. Thailand's Social Development and Human Security Ministry is in charge of collecting the samples and delivering them to a university in Bangkok where the dogs operate. So researchers say the dogs can detect a volatile compound secreted in the sweat of COVID-infected people.
The distinctive scent is what would appear after there's an infection. Different kinds of viruses will produce different kinds of scents, therefore they contain different smells. The canines are very sensitive towards scents excreted from human body, and they have better sense by hundreds of millions of times better than us humans, without even having to come into close contact with the virus.
Researchers say the dogs have a success rate of over 90% in detecting asymptomatic COVID patients. They say the canines have gone through thousands of samples since early May. Robots probably will never replace humans, but you must be worried they might steal your job in the future. A cook robot in Spain has risen to fame because of its ability to prepare paella, one of the world's most renowned national dishes. This robot is made up of an electronically controlled stove and a mechanical arm. It can put the already fried ingredients into the pan, add rice to it, and then stir it before pouring in the fish stock. The robot can prepare one paella at a time. However, all the ingredients have to be prepared and measured in advance. The Spanish company behind this product is trying to expand the robot's functionality.
They are designing what we have named Gastro Robot Menu, a robot gastronomic experience. Five chefs from the Basque Culinary Center are developing a five-course menu, so eventually we would take a seat in front of the robot and taste five courses designed by five important chefs.
Enrique says the product has already provoked interest outside Spain. He says some amusement parks and resorts in Japan already have their own paella robots. Paella masters believe the machine is a useful tool for chefs because they can cook many paellas at the same time. A French artist has placed the Eiffel Tower on a cliff using optical illusion on the famous landmark. In his work, street artist J.R. has removed the River Seine or Seine with an imaginary street that would go from the Trocadero to the Eiffel Tower. This work is a collage of several layers of paper which are not to last long due to the rain and the crowd that will walk on it. According to the artist's post on Instagram, the idea is to find a place perfectly reproducing the Eiffel Tower and have fun taking pictures by the imaginary cliff or jumping over the gaping chasm. Uh, As the world continues to battle COVID-19, people are finding traditional and modern ways of remembering those who have lost their lives due to the pandemic. The public library in the U.S. is commemorating the victims with an origami project. The Greenpoint Public Library in Brooklyn, New York City, has collected 1,000 origami pieces since April. Inspired by the ancient Japanese legend that 1,000 paper cranes can bring well wishes or healing, the library aims to promote hope and a sense of solidarity. The delicate handmade cranes, many of them from recycled paper, are now on display in the library's lobby. The staff hopes that each and every crane brings hope to the community.
We made this for the COVID Remembrance Day event, month-long event. Crane, in many cultures, especially in Asian culture, it symbolizes peace, love, recovery, and hope. And especially in Japanese culture, Senbutsu, 1,000 paper crane, is really significant. They believe that if one holds 1,000 paper crane, one's wishes come true.
The library has also asked people to come by and drop off their homemade origami as a memorial to the COVID-19 victims. It plans to keep up the display until at least the end of the summer. What was once an underground movement is now all the buzz. After a 17-year hiatus, billions of red-eyed cicadas are crawling their way above ground in the United States. These cicadas are known as brood eggs, and they are beginning to emerge from the depth of the earth in a dramatic fashion. These birds have been sighted in 15 eastern states of America. They are around 4 centimeters in length with unforgettable bright red eyes and iridescent wings. Experts say these insects don't hibernate. In fact, they grow slowly underground for 17 years before they emerge to mate.
There are several misconceptions about periodical cicadas. One is that they're locusts. They're not locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers. Cicadas are much more closely related to aphids. There's another misconception that cicadas are harmful. Cicadas are not harmful. They don't bite. They don't sting. They're not going to harm you or your pet, so you don't have to fear the cicada.
Michael says cicadas tend to thrive on the edges of sunlit forests where it's warmer. They live above ground as adults for about 3 weeks, long enough to reproduce before dying. They lay eggs inside young tree branches, which hatch a few weeks later to restart the cycle. This year's cicada class will bore into the ground and won't emerge until 2038.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Peruvian zoo has showed off two baby crocodiles that were born through artificial insemination. The zoo in Lima celebrated their birth 3 months ago. Zookeepers say the two crocs are in good health. The American crocodiles now weigh around 70 grams each and measure 26 centimeters in length. However, it's too early to determine the gender of the newborns. American crocodile is in danger of extinction due to pollution and habitat loss.
As Disneyland welcomes back the magic at it, has officially announced its reopening on the 17th of June. The famous theme park is currently in a second closure since the COVID-19 outbreak, being shut for nearly 8 months. With over 17,000 employees, Disneyland Paris cancelled its reopening plans twice because of the ongoing pandemic. But now, as France has eased its COVID-19 restrictions and tourist sites are gradually resuming their operations, the park has released a date to open its gates again. The reopening of Disneyland Paris will be the first time all six Disney resorts have been open since January 2020, when Shanghai Disneyland first closed due to COVID-19. A French musician has come up with an innovative idea to end his pandemic hiatus, performing on top of a mountain in Swiss Alps. Tiho performed on a platform at an altitude of 3,000 meters. The 30-year-old artist braved sub-zero temperatures in April to perform. He also had to overcome his fear of heights. Tiho has not performed in public for more than a year due to COVID-19 restrictions. He says the lockdown offers him a good chance to become more creative.
I feel like I had a lot of creativity during this period because I was stuck in the studio and a lot of time to make music. So usually when I perform gigs and I don't have so much time to spend in studio. So today, during these days, is like better.
A music production company organized the show. The small platform was taken up to the resort by helicopter. It took 4 hours to install the setting.
The Chinese version of the Titanic has been created to keep alive memories of the ship over a century after its ill-fated maiden voyage. The full-scale replica will soon be open to the public. It's part of a theme park in Sichuan Province, southwest China. The construction work started 6 years ago, involving over 100 workers. Around 23,000 tons of steel has been used to build a ship, which is 260 meters long. Designers hope that it will attract up to 5 million visitors a year.
This ship is located in the west part of China. It will attract tourists from the world. We estimate that the number of visitors will be between 2 million to 5 million in a year. This tourist volume should guarantee the return of our investment.
Everything in the duplication, from its cabins to the doorknobs, is identical to the original Titanic. Spending one night on the five-star ship costs around $150. The original luxury vessel sank in April 1912 after hitting an iceberg. Over 1,500 people died in the accident.
Animals living in the Paris Zoological Park will soon be able to see visitors again after months of just interacting with zookeepers due to COVID-19 restrictions. The zoo is preparing to reopen next week with limited numbers of visitors and obligatory health protocols. During the shutdown, the park welcomed over 60 new babies, including baboons, penguins, and flamingos. Experts believe the reopening will reawaken animals' curiosity.
Seeing public again will reawaken the animals' curiosity. They also look at the visitors. Some are very interested. You'll see the seals when they're with small children. It's part of enriching their environment to see a little bit of people, of diversity. So it's good for everyone.
The park, which temporarily closed last October, houses 2,500 animals of 234 species. France is now easing its COVID-19 restrictions and plans to reopen museums, zoos, shops, and cinemas on May the 19th.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, www.irib.org/en.
In the limelight. After criticisms over disproportionate and heavy-handed decisions to place EU nationals without the correct paperwork for entry into the United Kingdom in immigration removal centres for days, the Home Office has issued new guidance to its border force. We're prepared for you an article written by Brexit correspondent Lisa O'Carroll under the heading UK like an enemy state to EU nationals detained by border force. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. EU citizens living and working in the United Kingdom have revealed how they are being met with suspicion and threats that they will be refused entry at the UK border for the first time in their lives, fueling fresh fears that border force officials have not been trained in the new Brexit rules. Wolfgang, a German national who runs an IT business, was detained at Heathrow Airport despite having proof of settled status, indefinite leave to remain, and a British passport on the way. He is furious that his rights were suspended on the whim of a border force official. He said, "I have settled status," adding, "I have indefinite leave to remain. I'm about to become a British citizen. How is it that a border official with one tick can suspend those rights?" Wolfgang said from Germany, "To be blunt, I'm avoiding coming back to the United Kingdom now until I get my British passport," adding, "I pay a large amount of tax there. I have never used the health service. I contribute to Britain's economy, and I'm a property owner. Referring to the fact that the government has voted against giving EU citizens a residency card to show employers, landlords, or border officials, he said, "London is my favourite city, but I have no documents to show I can stay there." Wolfgang added, "They need to provide a document that guarantees that this is an irrevocable status, unless you have some sort of major criminal offence." Hilary Benn, a Labour MP and a former chair of the now disbanded Commons Brexit Select Committee, said cases such as Wolfgang's raise concern about what is in store for the 4.9 million EU citizens who have already been granted settled or pre-settled status, especially as they start to return from visits to their countries of birth when COVID restrictions are lifted. Hilary Benn added, "It's worrying to hear of these incidents happening. The Home Office needs to make sure that all Border Force staff are fully trained in applying the new rules." Referring to a new Brexit body set up in January to protect EU citizens' rights, Ben added, "This is something that the Independent Monitoring Authority needs to look at." Among the other cases is that of Antonio, a Spanish airline worker who was made to wait for 45 minutes at Gatwick whilst border officials tried to decide if he was lying when he told them he had pre-settled status. He said, "My passport was not associated with the settled status. When I told them that is because I applied using my ID card, which was perfectly acceptable to the Home Office, they told me that ID cards are no longer acceptable at the border." He was only let through after he produced his airline ID and his flight attendant schedule to prove he was not an illegal migrant. He said, "Because of my job, I have flown to many destinations and I have been through border controls in different countries. I felt I had landed in some random enemy state." He added, "This is the first time I felt intimidated by a police officer asking me questions just for being a foreigner living in the United Kingdom." For new arrivals with work visas, it is not plain sailing either. One Italian man arriving for a new job at a top British bank was confronted with officials unsure of the rules when he landed at London City Airport. Marco was detained for hours whilst border officials, who had refused his request to stamp the arrival date on his passport, pondered over a letter from his lawyer telling him he needed the official marking on his passport in order to take up his new job. Marco said, "I was escorted to a waiting room. After almost 3 hours, I was called by an officer who explained to me that it was a bit of a grey area, as my visa had been issued in electronic form and no guidance had been given by the government on how this would be formally recognised or recorded on one's passport." When he arrived at his new job, the first thing the Human Resource Department required was the stamp on his passport for their right to work check. Marco's case is one of half a dozen brought to the attention of The Guardian, which has reported how another cohort of EU citizens, those arriving to visit or to look for work, have been handcuffed, locked up, and had personal belongings removed from them before being deported. Colin Yeo, an immigration barrister and author of the Free Movement blog, said, "This is just how borders work, and this has been happening to everyone else from outside the European Union and is now just being applied to EU citizens. The whole point of free movement was to remove friction at the border. To deliberately reintroduce it was bound to have consequences." He said, "How Border Force is going to cope with this is hard to see. It is a huge job reimposing full controls between Britain and the European Union." The Home Office said it was unable to investigate the reports as it had not been provided details of the alleged persons involved. A spokeswoman for the Home Office claimed, "EU citizens are our friends and neighbours, and we want them to stay in the United Kingdom, which is why we launched our groundbreaking EU settlement scheme." She said, "Those who do not have status under the EU settlement scheme can enter the United Kingdom for up to 6 months as visitors, visa-free. However, now freedom of movement has ended, those coming to work or study must prove they meet our entry requirements. We urge people to check the requirements before traveling." She added, "We expect Border Force to treat all arrivals with respect and consider each passenger's situation on an individual basis. The British public expect us to check that everyone entering the United Kingdom has the right to do so, and passengers may be asked questions to establish the basis on which they are seeking to enter the United Kingdom." Meanwhile, it has emerged that UK ministers have told border officials to stop locking up European Union citizens in detention centres. After 48 hours of criticism over disproportionate and heavy-handed decisions to place EU nationals without the correct paperwork for entry into the United Kingdom in immigration removal centres for days, the Home Office has issued new guidance to its border force. It has advised border officials that, where appropriate, they should grant EU nationals immigration bail instead. This means passengers who are refused entry to the United Kingdom but cannot get an immediate flight home because of COVID travel restrictions will be permitted entry on bail conditions. A Home Office spokesperson said, "While international travel is disrupted due to the pandemic, we have updated our guidance to clarify that overseas nationals, including European Union citizens, who have been refused entry to the United Kingdom and are awaiting removal, should be granted immigration bail where appropriate." The spokesperson said, "Now freedom of movement has ended, people from across the European Union can continue to visit the United Kingdom, but those coming to work or study must meet our entry requirements, and we urge them to check before travelling." The Home Office came under pressure to act after a succession of stories of EU citizens, including Italians, Spaniards and Bulgarians, finding themselves in detention centres around Heathrow and Gatwick airports, surrounded by barbed wire and terrified. One Italian woman who was coming to the United Kingdom to improve her English on a short-stay visit to her uncle, an NHS consultant in London, told how she was sent to what she thought was a prison at Colnbrook Detention Centre near Heathrow Airport. She was expelled from the United Kingdom before her uncle was able to advocate on her behalf. The immigration barrister Colin Yeo said the new government guidance was welcome as a short-term fix for the Home Office to stop automatically detaining people in the detention centres instead of putting them on planes. But he said it was not a long-term solution to the fact many in the European Union do not know about the new rules because they're not obsessed with Brexit. Luke Piper, head of policy at the campaign group The 3 Million, said it was a carve-out solution that did not address the arbitrary decision-making of unnecessarily detaining people coming to this country, which he said was a historical problem that can't be resolved by removing one group from its impact.
In September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter and the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. It was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
America, it's hard time.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons, Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections, and Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should, therefore, carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
The chief of staff of the Israeli army, General Yitzhak Rabin, called on Foreign Minister Abba Eban to find a diplomatic solution to the issue, because Israel was not ready for war as it should be. On May 25, 1967, Eban went to the United States to know the U.S.'s opinion about their new problem.
I've been asked by my government to explore what these governments intend to do in order to reopen this international waterway to
what
a situation
do you want
of
the United
law.
States to do, sir?
Well, I've come here really to find out what the United States intends to do.
Lyndon B. Johnson, then President of the United States, told Eban that he did not want Israel to start a war. During this meeting, Johnson read part of the secret document to Eban. The document stated that Israel will not be alone unless it decides to go alone. The
Soviet Union said the same words to Egypt and urged them not to start a war. In practice, however, Egypt did start the war by closing the Strait of Tiran to Israel. The commanders in the Egyptian war room warned that if they wanted to wait for the first attack would be crippling for Egypt, and the chief of staff commented that if they allowed Israelis to carry out the first attack, they would only fight Israel. But if Egyptians started the attack, in addition to Israel, they must also fight the United States. In the same days, Hussein bin Talal, king of Jordan, visited Abd al-Nasser and assured him that he was still disgusted with Israel and ready for a possible war, and would help Egypt in the war against Israel. Hussein and Nasser signed a bilateral defense agreement, and Hussein practically ordered his army at the behest of Egypt. The situation became difficult for Israel. Egypt from the south, Jordan from the east, and Syria from the north were ready to attack Israel. Levi Eshkol was in crisis and wanted to know whether or not the United States had any plans to open the Strait of Tiran. But the United States was trapped in the purgatory of Vietnam War and had no patience for new troubles in the Middle East. Eshkol was disappointed with the U.S. support and, in consultation with his new defense minister, General Moshe Dayan, chose June the 5th to attack Egypt. At 7 o'clock in the morning, 180 Israeli fighters flew towards Egypt, and only 12 of them remained to defend the Israeli airspace. Minutes later, the runways of the Egyptian military airports were bombed and all the Egyptian fighters were targeted by Israeli rockets on the ground without even having a chance to start their engines. The Egyptian Air Force was completely destroyed. The Syrian and Jordanian air forces were also hit by these surprise attacks. Sinai Desert, Egyptian tanks were three times more than Israeli tanks, but there was no air cover for the Egyptian ground forces. The Egyptians had no choice but to withdraw. Egypt's defense minister, General Amr, ordered the withdrawal of their forces from the Sinai Desert, but there was no plan to retreat. As a consequence, Egyptian forces went towards the Suez Canal without any specific plan. Israeli fighters also took advantage of this opportunity and destroyed the Egyptian forces. This unplanned retreat damaged the Egyptian army. The Israelis have told Jordanians that they would not be in danger if they did not intervene in this war. At 10:30, Jerusalem al-Quds was hit by Jordanian artillery shells.
The Jordanian attack was unsuccessful, and the resistance of King Hussein's forces in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds did not last more than 10 hours. Jordan had the control of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank, but after the war, lost the control to Israel. It was Syria's turn after Jordan and Egypt. Israeli binoculars had control of the heights bordering Israel and Syria. After 12 hours of intense fighting, Israel captured the Golan Heights. The Soviet Union had already started a war with a false news. When the Soviet Union witnessed Israel attacking its communist ally, Syria, it gave an ultimatum to Israel's supporter, the United States, announcing that it was seeking military support for Syria. This was not just a bluff. Ukrainian jet fighters were ready by the order of the Soviet Union. The Soviet-American Cold War tension reached one of its most complicated moments. Lyndon B. Johnson and his colleagues had a meeting at the White House to find an answer to the Soviet ultimatum. He wrote to Kremlin that he would use every opportunity to stop the Israeli war machine, but in practice, instead of calling the Israeli Prime Minister in a formal action, he told the U.S. representative to the UN to talk to the Israeli representative. The U.S. envoy saw the Israeli representative at the lobby and gave him the message.
United States Ambassador Goldbeck asked me to come out into the lobby and to say to me, you must immediately announce that the fighting is over.
But this was not within the power of the Israeli ambassador to the UN. The Israeli representative talked to Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eben about the issue. Eben immediately called Eshkol's house to tell him that the international pressure had increased and he had to stop the war as soon as possible at the request of the U.S. But Eshkol was watching the beauties of the Golan Heights with his commanders at the time. His wife gave him Eben's important message.
Eshkol, listen. Ivan wants you to stop the war. He can't take the pressure. He said, I can't hear you. What do you mean you can't hear me? I'm telling you in Ivan's exact words. He says, I can't hear you, I can't hear you. It's a bad line, it's a bad line.
But the Prime Minister did not consider the message and continued his work. Eben realized that Eshkol needed more time to advance on Syrian territory. It exactly happened, and they reached all their goals in Syria. The Israeli ambassador to the UN received the text of the agreement. He had to read it aloud to the UN Security Council. This was the end of the war.
Israel accepts any proposal made by General Bull for the implementation of the Security Council ceasefire resolution and the arrangements for the supervision of the ceasefire.
Israel volunteered for peace because it had large areas of land to exchange. The Golan Heights from Syria, Old City of Jerusalem al-Quds, the West Bank from Jordan, as well as the Sinai Desert and Gaza from Egypt. The Israelis were ready to return the Golan Heights to Syria and the Sinai Desert to Egypt. But they had an important condition for peace, and that was acceptance and recognition of the independent state of Israel by the Arabs. Eben went to the United States to discuss Israel's offer with the Americans, but recognizing Israel was not something that Gamal Abdel Nasser and the rest of the Arabs wanted. The hero of the Egyptian people, who could neither make peace with Israel nor had the power to stop their military machine, had no choice but to resign. People were shouting, either Nasser or no one else, in Cairo. They were not satisfied with the resignation of Gamal Abdel Nasser. Nasser remained Egyptian president, but did not comply with the Soviet-U.S. peace agreement. In September of 1967, Arab leaders gathered at the Khartoum summit and said, no peace with Israel, no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel. course, the Arabs did not have other alternatives, and Israel did not return the occupied territories to them. On September the 28th, 1970, after the end of the emergency meeting of the Arab summit, Gamal Abdel Nasser felt a pain in his chest. He died the same night in front of Anwar Sadat's eyes. So the vice president became the president of Egypt, and many thoughts were running through his mind. 6 years had passed since the Israeli occupation of Sinai, and Egypt's third president dreamed of retaking a piece of land that had fallen to the Zionists during the Six-Day War. Sadat continued Nasser's strategy, so a new war was on the horizon. Sadat started the game with the Soviet Union. The U.S. supported Israel, and Egypt needed the support of the opposite pole. The Soviet Union played its trump card, shifting the balance of power in favor of Egypt. The Soviet Union prepared some advanced missiles, missiles that could challenge the security of Israeli jet fighters. Everything was ready for a new war. Egyptian SAM missiles were ready to target any Israeli element within 15 miles of the Suez Canal. Anwar as-Sadat was not alone in this war, and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad was with him. The attack had to take place in complete surprise. The promised day was chosen in the Allied front, and Syria from the east and Egypt from the west started attacking Israel, and the targets were again the Golan Heights and Sinai. Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement in Hebrew, and this day is one of the most important holidays in the Jewish calendar. Jews attend synagogue 4 times on Yom Kippur and pray. Egypt was aware of this. On October the 6th, 1973, as the Zionists were waking up to prepare for the festival, they were hit by surprise attacks on 2 fronts of Sinai and the Golan Heights, the same areas occupied by Israel in the Six-Day War in 1967. The first decision of the Israeli war room was to let the jet fighters counter the aggression, and the permission was in the hands of one person, Israel's fourth prime minister, Golda Meir. But she did not give the permission. Meir believed that if Israel wanted to attract international attention after the Six-Day War, it had to be recognized as a victim of Yom Kippur aggression. The war had begun. The Egyptian commandos crossed the Suez Canal under their own heavy artillery fire and entered the Sinai Desert. The first Israeli fighters were allowed to fly, but as soon as they approached the Suez Canal, they were destroyed by SAM missiles. Inevitably, the Israeli tanks started attacking, but the Egyptians had thought about that too. The Sagar anti-tank missile made Sinai a graveyard for Israeli tanks. Sagar anti-tank guided missiles were again the result of Egyptian friendship with the Soviet Union. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
When the protests started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring, days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying, or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief: a clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. The article you're about to hear has been written by David W. McIver, an associate professor of political science at Colorado State University and the author of Mourning in America: Race and the Politics of Loss. The piece is titled May 25th Should Be a Day of Mourning for George Floyd. Stay with us for more of David McIver's article. When the protests started in the streets of Denver, Colorado last spring, days after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, I watched dozens of people marching with anguish and affliction on their faces. Several of them were crying, or clearly had been. When I watched the video of the final moments of George Floyd's life, I myself felt the telltale symptoms of grief: a clenched stomach, a surge of adrenaline, and an overwhelming sense of powerlessness. As they unfolded over the next days and weeks, the protests seemed like a moment when black grief, a feeling familiar for black Americans after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, Trayvon Martin, Emmett Till, and so many others, might finally become collective grief for the rest of America. The crowds were multiracial, united, emotive, insistent. They marched night after night, giving the unfolding events of last May and June a dreamlike quality, magnified by the fact that they took place in the similarly surreal days of COVID-19 lockdowns. It was a time full of unexpected surprises. Minneapolis said it would dismantle its police department. Deep uncertainty: can it do that? And wild swings between hope and anguish, possibility and anxiety. Maybe it was just a moment, though, a brief disruption of a relatively unchanging situation. Violence against black lives has continued since the day George Floyd was murdered. Meanwhile, the brief and striking shift in public opinion towards the Black Lives Matter social movement steadily declined, especially among white Americans. Political debate and partisan identities have returned to their familiar polarized pattern. Popular discourse once again largely dissociates from black pain. One year later, it is easy to be cynical about this moment of collective grief. But there is another way of thinking about this, that is still possible to build on the moment of shared grief over the death of George Floyd in order to see a way towards a more democratic and just coexistence. There is an intimate yet still unexplored relationship between mourning and democracy. We tend to see mourning as a temporary disruption of normal life, a cycle of pain, denial, and eventually acceptance. This picture is both right and wrong. Mourning is a movement towards wholeness by way of acknowledging brokenness. but it is less a terminable process than a way of being in the world. To see this better, we have to appreciate the role that attachment and ambivalence play in mourning. Mourning implies attachment. We mourn only for those to whom we are connected, or for that to which we are committed. In the case of George Floyd, who became a public figure only through his death, the communal mourning that followed was less about the specific life that was lost than the democratic ideals that were so clearly violated, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that was extinguished for Mr. Floyd and for too many others. Public mourning, then, is the expression of grief when the longing for social recognition and equal justice is unrequited. Mourning also confronts us with an experience of ambivalence. It is a pivot between life and death, past and future, love and hatred, openness and defensiveness, and reparation and destruction. A democratic politics of mourning implies not only the clarification of our public ideals and commitments, our civic attachments, but also a wrestling with the ambivalence in American history and American psyches. Mourning is the work not only of integrating what has been lost into our personality, but also of integrating the personality itself, our fears and our hopes, our vulnerabilities and our power. To do this, we first have to overcome the defenses that dissociate us from the pain of loss, our own pain and that of others. Often in times of grief, narratives of innocence and immorality, of absolute good and abject evil, deflect or defend against an experience of ambivalence. Instead of a complex picture of identity and history that might inspire dialogue and collaborative action, the raw energy of mourning is channeled through the quick and relatively easy identification of scapegoats or magical fixes. But public mourning can also manifest something different, precisely because it can open up a dreamlike space of possibility. This is what the psychoanalyst Dr. D.W. Winnicott called potential space. For Dr. Winnicott, cultural activities like a protest, although he did not use that example, are both real and surreal. They take place in the realm of shared reality, but they are not reducible to this reality because they are also imbued with aspects of dreaming, such as free association, playful juxtaposition, and a fluid sense of time. It is the dreamlike nature of cultural life that makes creativity possible, what Dr. Winnicott linked to play. Following Dr. Winnicott, we see mourning as a space where we acknowledge loss and ambivalence by playing with the possibilities for different, more creative responses to loss. And this brings me back to the George Floyd protests. The initial protests occurred in potential space, a mixture of dream and reality, and despite the resumption of familiar discourses in their wake, there are signs that new possibilities have emerged from that moment. For example, there is a notable spike of interest in truth and reconciliation processes and racial equity initiatives. The Divided Community Project at The Ohio State University recently published a practical guide for such initiatives, which could take place in networks of civic associations, within school districts, or at municipal, state, or national levels. No doubt, any such efforts would be imperfect, but they would also represent tentative steps into a democratic work of mourning with unknown consequences. What we do know is that conversations across social difference can result in greater levels of understanding and trust. We have a proof of concept, but we can lack larger structures or rituals of